I managed to sketch this thing out yesterday, and that's about as far as we got. And I need to say, first of all, that these lines, while they appear hard and fast, are not hard and fast. And you know it as well as I do. They're semi-permeable membranes, if you will. That is to say, you don't have to look very far to hit Dorothy Day coming straight out of this one, and is clearly deeply into social justice. And you don't have to visit many Methodist churches before you realize, or Lutherans certainly, that there's a great deal of liturgy. And my kids used to say when they were little, it makes a difference which syllable you put the emphasis on.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. If you were going to separate them in some funny, funky way, you would probably say that if at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning you could only do one of two things, and it could only be done at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, and one is to take the Mass and the other is to build a Habitat for Humanity, these people are going to go build the Habitat. These people are going to go take the Mass or the Eucharist or Communion. And it's the old faith and works thing. It's as old as Christianity. Probably it's as old as religion, as a matter of fact. And liturgicals are increasingly Pentecostal. All you have to do is sit up in that chancel the way I did Sunday night and in that good Episcopal church, see how many hands were up like this, beginning to do some expression of charismatic Pentecostal, and vice versa. And probably no more conservative body in the world than Assemblies of God, or unless it's Church of God in Christ, which goes along down here. So these are membranes. They're not intended to be permanent things. Now, what Pannenberg, whom I continue to credit with this because we think that's right, what Pannenberg said was that as we began to urbanize, and it was clear by the late 60s that we were deep into the process of urbanization, as we began to urbanize, as we began to lose biblical literacy, as we began to lose the home as the conservator of the faith, and as we began with the result of the car to move away, even if we didn't move to the city, and most of us now, very few of us, I forgot the percentage, actually live anywhere near the place of birth. We break our roots, our natal roots, and we go elsewhere to do our living. And what he said was that over here, there's always the greatest energy in Christianity in the last 200 or 300 years, and certainly the greatest energy in this country in the last 200 years, has been over here in the conservative, especially if you put an evangelical up there for the word instead of conservative. It has been in this quadrant where the energy was. And the second greatest part of the energy has been over here in the renewalist post-Azusa Street Pentecostal movement. Those are your energy banks. What Pannenberg said was, and he didn't put it this simply, but what's going to happen is that you're going to get some sweet little Baptist girl. He certainly didn't put it this way, probably horrified, but basically this is the idea. You're going to get some sweet little Baptist girl, age 21, 22, just finished college, first person in her family maybe to finish college, maybe not, but she's going to the city. She's certainly the first one to leave mama. Back in wherever, the suburbs or the village or the small town, she's going to go to the big city and she's going to get herself a job, which she does. And she gets that job, and the last thing on her mind is the need to go to church. She faintly remembers being Baptist. She may even have had a fairly active Baptist existence. I don't know why I'm picking on Baptist, but anyway, it's easy. They're an easy target. I know.
Were you studying and bothered?
Yeah, okay. All right. I have to tell you, I have two Baptist degrees, and one of the things that breaks my heart most is to see the Southern Baptist Convention. I was a fellow of the university at Furman University. Great school. But anyway, that's aside from what we're doing. So this sweet little Baptist girl she calls home about once a month. And she has a great deal of respect for her mama. She probably was active in young people right up until about 16 or 17, along in there, when she wandered away from the young people's program, and that was kind of it. So she's not entirely biblically illiterate, but she's not what you call highly informed. And she's certainly not highly motivated. And she's in the city by herself, and so she just never manages to go to church, except on the Sunday before she's supposed to call her mama the next night, and then she manages to go, but that's about the extent of it. And it's not for godly reasons, it's just for safe and political ones that she does go. But in the course of things, she meets where she's working, either on an assembly line, or she meets in the cubicle next to her cubicle at the office, who knows. She meets a little girl, or another young woman, shall we say, who is Pentecostal. Pentecostal also has just come to town and just got her own condo and is sort of rootless and is not living anywhere near mama and daddy, etc., etc. You get the picture. They get to talking. In the early 90s, we called it water cooler theology. Now there are no water coolers. We carried around in bottles, so we had to find a new name, but a coffee pot theology or something. Because there is some natal memory of church, eventually conversation turns around to church at some point. And it's casual. But the little conservative discovers to her surprise that the renewalist over here believes in healing and believes in the power of prayer in a slightly different way from the way she does. And so they talk. And the first thing you know, they're going to a movie one night together. And the next, you know where I'm going. And then it's not long before they start having coffee together on Saturday morning. Then it's not long before they discover another young woman up here who thinks they're both a little weird, but who has these wonderful things. She's got, you know, smells and bells. She's got pictures on her refrigerator that and on her desk wall also of saints that are really lovely. She understands all kinds of things about the Christian year that they never knew were there. And the colors change, and when she remembers the colors used to change. And they can go to evening prayer, and it's really kind of cool. And then they go to a Taze service, and that's really cool. Doesn't have much to do with Jesus Christ, but it's cool, you know, and it makes you feel good. And the first thing you know, of course, the three of them are hanging out. And then they're beginning to swap ideas, and at some point, inevitably, they meet somebody over here because they're good kids. And because they realize they need to make some sort of contribution. So they go to a soup kitchen to help, or they go man a food pantry, or they go build a Habitat for Humanity's house, whatever. What we're getting is a social group, of course, that's formed out of the melange. We're no longer in the village where everybody is a Baptist, or everybody is a Methodist, or everybody is the community church of which there is only one, and it's generic Protestant. We're getting a mix like this. And as they mix, they socialize. It's a Starbucks form of religion, maybe more than a water cooler. But they socialize. And the first thing you know, they really are beginning to honestly meet. They're taking one night a week to absolutely sit down and talk about religion. And they pick up other people, and they meet other people. And the first thing you know, they've got a house church. And the first thing you know, their house church grows and grows and grows. Or maybe it just stays the size it is. Maybe it's that another girl, just like the first one, goes to Starbucks all the time and she meets up at Starbucks. Or maybe it's a guy and he goes to the local pub and he meets other people there who aren't churched any longer. But the conversations begin, and they begin spontaneously. And nobody makes them happen. It's a self-organizing situation. And what happens is, you get all of these little gatherings around. And they don't cohere in any way. There's six folk over here. This pub has 30. Starbucks maybe has a meeting every Tuesday night. Maybe there are 14 or 15 people. And before it's over, they begin to find each other. And what they make is a cohort. Or that's its religious name. We called it by its biological name yesterday. They made slime mold. You know, they are little integers, all of them, without any real connection until they come together in a cohort. And they don't come together in a cohort very often, but within a geographic area, maybe 20 or 25 of these little gatherings will come together and they'll make a cohort. Sometimes out of a cohort will spring up a church. The other thing that can sometimes happen is that from one of these quadrants, increasingly from this one, interestingly enough, originally it was from the evangelical conservative one, you will find a pastor or even an unordained person who feels the call to begin to do something deliberate, to plant a church up out of one of these things. You cannot make an emergence church happen from the top down. You cannot go in there and say, I'm going to make me an emergence church. It won't work. By very definition, you've not let it self-organize or self-initiate. But you can take one of these little groups and say, you know, there are five or six of us meeting every Tuesday night. I think we really should maybe do more than, maybe we should decide who's the leader here. Or maybe we should decide who's going to play the role of pastor here. And let's see if, and the first thing you know, we might actively invite some people we know to come And then we're 30 people. And by the time we're 30 people, then we probably, you know, we need somebody, something bigger than the living room. So maybe we'll go rent an old storefront. Or maybe we will go down to the Lutheran church and say, can we borrow your basement on Tuesday night? And the Lutheran church says, yes, something. And that's how the thing grows. It's self-organizing. And what happens is that increasingly it swirls and swirls. And it's something, my guess right now, and nobody knows for sure, that's the reason I question the 8 million, my guess right now is that somewhere close to 20 to 25% of American Christians are in this center and are practicing their faith within this center. At some point, it ought to go to be some close, somewhere between 40 and 50% of Americans will be doing emergence Christianity in just this formless. The only time it's going to have any kind of form is that brief slime mold period when a cohort comes, and a cohort will come together once, twice, three times a year. But they begin to know each other. And if you can think of a cohort, if you can think of it as a spider web, and the cohort is kind of the center, and they're all connected this way, and they're connected this way, but it's still a web. And the real entity is each of the things out here. The entity is not the web. The web, the internet, is the thing that holds it together. And very little of physical coming together. And this is what you get. And this is what, and it always has gone this way. Interestingly enough, the energy has almost always goes this way. Because Pallenberg was right. The energy was here in this quadrant. The next greatest energy was here. And the movement has always been this way. Except every once in a while, you get one who looks aberrant, does not look emergent, feels like it should be emergence Christian, but doesn't perform like it. And it will be because, for some reason, he or she has gone this way. The one you know best is Jim Wallace, who came out of this, Sojourner, came out of this quadrant and went that way, went straight to social justice without going this way. But this is far and away the way to move. The other thing that we need to probably note here, just out of intellectual honesty, if nothing else, is there are two groups that aren't here. The Mormons are not here. Most scholars now regard Mormons as the fourth Abrahamic, as opposed to being another branch of Christianity. And I believe that to be a good assessment. If you can say that Christianity is a branch of Judaism, then you can say perhaps that Mormonism is a branch of Christianity. But there are distinct doctrinal differences, so they're not there. The other thing is that the Quakers aren't here because the Quakers are right here. By definition, the Quakers lived in both of these quadrants. And it was originally, it was the Quaker theologians in this country who began to give emergence Christianity its first theological basis. You know, Parker Palmer, Richard Foster, Dallas Willard to some extent, Bill Brent, Brent Bill rather, all of our Quaker thinkers. And they were drawn on heavily. The other great source of theology for the early part of emergence in this country was John Wimber of the Vineyard, of whom we spoke yesterday. John Wimber, who came up, he was an adult convert to Christianity and was first trained in the Quaker tradition, and went into the Vineyard when it was only two churches and failing and floundering, and did that thing I just talked about, and began to grow it. There is in emergence Christianity, as there is in evangelicalism, a strong entrepreneurial urge, and one of the things that may get it in trouble is its entrepreneurial clergy, because they're there to make the things work. And to support themselves and to grow. So anyway, they are right there. Now, all of this is essentially, I want to, well, let me do it this way. Let me do this. These are the percentages of those who aren't, who are going to resist this, who are going to say, this is wrong, I have a God-given vocation to kill this thing, to not let this happen. When people speak of the new rose, when you hear the expression the new rose, this is what they're talking about. The rose was the flower of the Reformation, and the new rose is this. It's this diagram right here, Pottenberg's diagram, is right here. Now, what I want to do, having built it, is to erase it and redraw it, if I may, in order to get to the theology involved. I said yesterday that two things annoy me One about people's comments about emergence. One is the notion that it's a young people's thing and that it's going to go away, which is kind of like the old Carol Burnett joke that children and their grandparents get along so well because they share a common enemy. it's the emergents get along so well because they squeezed out that middle section in there, but it is not a young people's phenomenon. It is older citizens and younger citizens. The 40s to 60s are in a world of hurt, and we're going to talk about them in just a minute. But it's a phenomenon. The other thing that really annoys me is the notion that we would have the audacity to say that there is no theology. The theology of emergence is enormously sophisticated, very sophisticated. Now, I'm going to draw it back, and I'm going to draw it, now it really is mathematically way out of kilter. And I'm going to put my liturgicals back up here, and I'm going to put my social justice here, and my renewalists here, and my conservatives here, all right, in order to clear this space. Now, this line is no longer there. It's still there, but I had to remove it. I said a minute ago, it matters where you put the emphasis, and indeed it does. When Pottenberg drew this thing originally, he was very shrewd in how he did it. Everybody above the line believes, or the people up here are put together, or were put together, because they believe in orthopraxy. That is, the defining reason for putting these two groups of Christians together above the center line that's no longer there is that they are held together by orthopraxy. Those down here are held together by orthodoxy. That is to say, their defining characteristic is in both of these. And again, it's a matter of emphasis. Ortho is a really good long product, but it also is the Greek, as you know, for the word right. And orthodoxy means right belief, and orthopraxy, right practice. And we can be really silly about it, but down here, it truly matters more what you believe than what you do. Up here, it matters more what you do than what you believe in general. The best example I have down here is a former college friend. She's dead now, but best Baptist I ever saw. Absolutely, and it was sincere, and she meant it every lick of it. I loved her to death, I would go see her. She lived way back in the country, and I would go see her sometimes, but it's like 400 miles, so you didn't do it very often. And she absolutely knew it was wrong to drink. There was no question that it was wrong to drink. But when I was going to go see her, within 36 hours of before I would leave, I'd get the phone call. And the phone call would say, don't forget to bring communion. And sometimes we would commune 3 and 4 times in an afternoon after I would get there, you know, because it was on my Anglican soul. And she loved to see me come. And the worst part of it was that I started her on Carlo Rossi, and before she died, she was up to Kendall Jackson, and I thought, I can't afford this. Who knew a Baptist would ever develop a palate? But it was absolutely wrong. To sit down in her own house and have a drink at 5 o'clock, because it was 5 o'clock, would have been unthinkable. But to call it communion with an Anglican friend, you could just guzzle it away. I've seen her belt 4 down in an afternoon. I can't even do that, and I'm experienced. just amazing, just amazing. But she was a good Baptist, and so it mattered what she believed, not what she did. And I love it. My other favorite example in the upper part of this is my husband's a pulmonologist, or was. He's retired now. And he once had a patient who had already had some lung difficulty, there's no question. Good Lutheran woman. 66 years old she was, and her joy in life was with the fair linens, fixing the fair linens that are required for draping the altar and all in Lutheran tradition. And she had just completed a new set of fair linens, and she was so proud of them. And she took them in to the pastor, and the pastor looked and said, but you've only got 14 stitches to the inch. It's supposed to be, under the new rubric, 17 stitches to the inch. And she had to rip it all out and start over. And it so stressed her that she went into lung failure, into lung crisis, and was in the hospital for 6 weeks getting over the emotional trauma of having to rip all of her fair linen out. Who knew God cared about three stitches to an inch? You know, only Lutherans care about that. The Almighty doesn't. And in our communion as Anglicans, if you're on altar gale duty, on altar duty, and you take the chalice after the service is over, and you wash it out, and if you happen to pour the water down into the sink instead of the piscina, that being an unplumbed basin, God help your immortal soul. You just threw the body of Christ into the sewer. See, and that's a no-no. And so you do like, I don't know how many mea culpas if you make that mistake. You have to remember to throw it in the piscina so it goes straight to the earth and not to the sewer. It's all kinds of silly things, but they're there. And one of the pleasures of emergence Christians is to laugh at both sides of the spectrum and to say both of you are pathetic. I'm sort of the opinion they're correct. Both of us are sort of pathetic. They countered early on with keeping the ortho, with orthonomy. Now, I know it looks like orthonomy, but don't say orthonomy. You've got to keep the ortho part, okay? So it's orthonomy. It makes no sense. It's as silly as what they're objecting to, but God help you if you pronounce it like it looks. It's orthonomy. Honomos, as you remember also from your Greek, is originally it was a Pythagorean word, and it was used by the Pythagoreans to name that set of harmonic laws that made the music. It's the laws of a harmonic principle. Then we adapted it, the Christian church began to use it, and the Septuagint before that, began to use it to mean right law. That is, it really is the honomos is the law. It is the perfection of God. It is all of the godliness of God, if you will. And orthonomy is to understand and to apply, to really take that which makes the music. And to believe that that's what religion should be about. And my best example of orthonomy happened several years ago. I was speaking, as I mentioned the other day, yesterday, that the virgin birth is a hotly contested issue in Christianity, or it was for a while. And several years ago, I was speaking at the Cathedral of St. Philip's in Atlanta. And it was an adult meeting, and they wanted to talk about the virgin birth and the doctrine thereof, about which I knew remarkably little, but we managed to do it anyway. It was a supper meeting, and the young people were serving supper. And there was this kid, 17 at the most, but probably 16, 17, anyway, who was scraping the dishes like this as I talked. And then he scraped less and less and less. Finally, he gave up and went to the door of the kitchen and was listening. And before it was over, he went all the way up into the gallery and was standing like this looking. And when it was all over, everybody left except the kid. And the kid came down and he said to me, "May I ask you something?" And I said, "Certainly. What is it?" He said, "I don't understand about that virgin birth thing." And I said, "What don't you understand?" And he said, "It's so absolutely beautiful, it has to be true whether it happened or not." That's orthonomy. That's orthonomy. It's one of the reasons that aesthetics is a big part of worship right now. It's one of the reasons that music sometimes can carry a truth that doctrine can't. It's one of the reasons we had a painter this morning, that sometimes the image can carry the beauty. It's a highly defensible form of doctrine, unless you're Jewish. If you're Jewish, the good rabbi will say to you instantly, that's the Kitsian error, or the Kitsian heresy, which is what Judaism calls it. That is to say that beauty is truth and truth is beauty, and it's not true, the good rabbi will say. You better find something better than that to discover what to say where your theology lies. The fact that it makes the music isn't sufficient to prove that it's godly. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the rabbi is right. And so part of the emergence movement countered seven or eight years ago now with theonomy. They so countered that they got rid of the ortho, unfortunately, and put the theo there. And they said, essentially, after 25 million words had been spent on it, they got around to saying that what we're really talking about is that only God knows what makes the music, and we'd better be done God's way. Now, I yesterday tried to talk about the difference between emerging and emergent, and right here it is. This is Mark Driscoll at Mars Hill in Seattle. This is an emerging Christian who would rather die than be called emergent. This is emergent over here, all the way over on this point. And this is Mars Hill. Mars Hill in Grand Rapids is probably somewhere along in here. Solomon's Porch in Minneapolis is all the way over here. All right, it's Tony Jones and Doug Padgett are its primary leaders. They're all the way. This is the nature of the contention. Interestingly enough, if you Google either of these words, you very quickly discover that they both were used in philosophy, and this one, by the way, in marine biology. Interestingly enough, though, I never quite figured out how. In Australian philosophers have used them to an entirely different meaning. Now they've been primarily preempted by emergence Christianity. Now, Brian McLaurin, whom most of you know or know of, I'm sure, and whose book A Generous Orthodoxy is on your list. Generous Orthodoxy is to emergence like the 95 Theses was to the Reformation. McLaurin is the Luther of this movement, whether he wishes to be or not. And he really didn't, like Luther, he didn't want to start, he didn't want to become the spokesman for a revolution, and he's terribly unhappy every time something, but it's nonetheless true. McLaurin has a book forthcoming sometime next fall, I don't know when, and I was given the opportunity to, or I was asked to bid before it went to typeset. When it comes out, the most remarkable thing to me is that he has gone over here and he has introduced two new orthos. And this will be on the streets by December 1st sometime. One of them is orthopathy. It looks like orthopathy, but it's orthopathy, built off of the word patwell, which I can't spell. Pathos. What am I doing wrong?
P-A-T-H-O-S.
Okay, pathos, I'm sorry. And ortho-affinity, which he does hyphenate. And what he's saying is that orthonomy, that the belief that beauty matters, has to be tempered with or has to be understood in terms of also huge compassion. If that which is beautiful violates compassion, then it's wrong. And it must also be defined within community. It must be, the community must agree that that's where the beauty is, that that's where the music is. And so he is tempering this one with these two. It's a major step forward in their theology. Whatever else emergence Christianity is, it is first and foremost communitarian. It is absolutely involved with community, and community is going to be the gatekeeper on everything about it. This is what they're doing with that part of it. Now, what I want to do is also get rid of this and really screw up the map here, if I may, and draw another picture. And this one looks like this. And I'm going to ask you to pretend that this little dot right here is somewhere around 40% of American Christianity. That's emergence Christians, all right? And it doesn't look like 40%. I'm aware it doesn't look like 40%. But I have to have the space in order to do what I'm about to do. Around that center of emergence Christianity, there are concentric rings. I need one more. And it's absolutely true that these people are going to continue to hold their ground, all right? This outer ring, which looks huge, is out there simply because it's the farthest from the center. It's the smallest. These are the people in Protestantism in this country right now who are our traditionalists. Traditionalists. I can't seem to spell this morning up here. They're the ones we were talking about yesterday. That's the dear woman one of you said, who said, frankly, just don't mess with it until I die, and then after that, I don't care. It was Wade who said it. Yes. This is the guy who looks you dead in the eye and says, my daddy paid for that organ, and by God, it's going to play when I die, and after that, you can do whatever you want to, but you're going to bury me with my daddy's organ. A few funerals are going to take care of it. I meant that yesterday. They really are. I met the most charming young priest not long ago who said, you know, they drive me crazy. They absolutely obstruct everything. It's not that they care so much about the faith or the nature of the gospel. It's that they don't want anything moved. You know, don't move my cheese. Just let me, I'm too old to contend. And he said, they drive me crazy because the immediate answer to everything is no, regardless of what the question is, just no. But he said, I find myself taking them to one of them to lunch about every other week. He said, I've got two, and I keep taking them to lunch. And I said, why? And he said, I don't know, it makes me so miserable to do it, but the truth of it is, I learn something every time I take one of them. Something I didn't learn in seminary, or something I learned about the church, or something about the building that I didn't know. And I've been there 7 years, he said. But I keep on courting these people simply because they really are kind of dear if they just shut up and go away. And I was very sympathetic with him. I understand what he's saying. And one of the most fascinating things to me, and it's become a sore, I think I mentioned it to some of you in private conversation. Every once in a while, you'll get a church that's in real difficulty. It'll be down to 50 people, and it'll be this massive building, you know, that they're stuck with. And they call and they say, or the supervisor, I just did a Methodist church, supervisor, district supervisor called and said, will you please come talk to these folk? And what you go in and see is that if there are too many of the traditionalists, the deal breaker, the litmus test about whether they can change or not, whether that facility can house an emergence church or not, is one simple thing every single time. And that question is, can you unscrew the pews? And if they can't, if they've got too many traditionalists and they can't unscrew the pews, it's never going to happen. You would think it would be the organ or it would be the choir or something, but it's always the pews. The pews come with the Reformation. And this is not an anti-Reformation 2 days, by the way. But one of the gifts of the Reformation was pews. That's where we got them, you know, because we became people of the Word. And we put that box up there and made the man stand there and talk to us. And to keep us from wandering around and not hearing what he says, we screwed down the pews. And one of the marks of emergence Christianity is no pews, all kinds of chairs. Bring in some sofas, overstuffed chairs if you want them, you know, or bring in just folding chairs, but no pews because it makes the space rigid. And it's hierarchy, and it assumes the man up here is going to tell you how to do it. And we're not going to have that. And if in the middle of the sermon we decide we want to go play cards in the back corner, we want to be able to take our chairs over there and go play cards in the back corner, which will tell the old boy he's not doing too well, among other things, or maybe, you know, whatever. But it's exactly like cathedrals used to be 600 years ago, you know, where the cows came in and the pigs came in and the... But the traditionalist is hard to work around, and it truly is a deal breaker every time. Interior to them is the re-traditionalist. Gosh, this is terrible. Okay, now we're in. Now here is my layer in the middle. This one's worth starring because there's growth here. When this is where the growth is in terms of the traditional or standing denominations. These are people who want to be more Calvin than John Calvin was, who want to be more Baptist than Smith and Wellesley ever dreamed of being, who would like to be more Methodist than the Wesleys were. These are the people who say, you know, my family for 150 years has been Methodist, and I believe that that's the center, that's my tradition, that's my part of Christianity. I'm going to plant my flag there. The rest may be right or the rest may be wrong, but this works for me. And the reason they're growing is that a lot of them are in that sandwich generation. They are 35 at the youngest, most of them, usually 40 to 45, and they go all the way over to 60. And they're coming with their children. One of the things, we used to say that people would come to church with their kids in order to get a moral, to make a moral good people, and as soon as a kid went to college, then they quit going to church as well. That's not true anymore. These people, yes, they're bringing their children, absolutely they are, but they're bringing them to learn the faith. Not to necessarily become good moral people. They really want them to know. And when there is stress, you know it as well as I do, when there is stress, we love the rules. When there is stress, we love the pattern. When there is confusion, we love it when somebody can tell us how to walk through the confusion. And a lot of this is exactly that reaction. The scholar of choice here is Diana Butler Bass. And the word is of her making, not of mine. She has made the word actually sort of a buzzword, if you will, in contemporary American sociology of religion. It's a very real group. And when you see a church, I don't know about Grace, but I loved it the other night when Celeste was telling me that when Grace split and New Grace split off, it took almost all of Grace's members, and that when she came here to Grace Episcopal 4 years ago, I think she said, there were only 60 folk still left in Grace Church. They're now over 400. And I so wanted to say, and what's your age demographic? Have you got young people, or are they primarily over 40 and under 60? I didn't ask her because we were roving for the commencement service and it didn't seem appropriate, but I'll bet you that's exactly what we've got. And church after church that is showing, individual churches instead, that is showing this enormous growth within the standing denominations, is usually in that ring. Interior to them are the progressives. And I do these folk badly. And I always begin with an apology, and I hate that. The probably the most visible spokesman of the progressives is a man named Eric Elness, and he too is on the bibliography. And his 95 theses, or his generous orthodoxy, or whatever you want to call it, is the Phoenix Affirmation. And it's a little tiny book. It stacks about like this, and the trim on it is about this big. You can read it in about 10 minutes, and it'll take you about 10 hours to figure out what he just told you. And not that it's obtuse. It's not. But to really perceive the depth of what it is he's working on. Eric and I have been colleagues for several years now. He's far younger than I. And he says, I pray for you, and I covet those prayers. Simply because, as I said yesterday, I'm a Christian particularist, or an exclusivity, or whatever. I'm not arrogant enough to think that, to assume that God can't save mankind by any means he may choose, and in any language he may choose. But from the point of view of what I've been given, Christianity is it, and there is but one way, that no man cometh unto the Father but by me. Now, if God wants to make the me appear in other places in some way, so be it. But one of the places my age shows is when we get to this. And also, as a sort of would-be sociologist, I'm scared to death of China and syncretism. I don't know how you can look at contemporary China with its syncretic form of religion and not be really concerned about the potential for universality or universalism or whatever you want to call it. But the progressives are very aware that we have a problem, and that problem is the first subordinate question that I mentioned yesterday. We don't have a theology of religion. And to their great credit, they're doing some of the heavy lifting. Hal Tuzig is one of their better known theologians. Elness himself is doing some heavy lifting. On what do you do? How do you live in a multi-faith culture without becoming syncretic? Where's the answer to that? So they are very close, or certainly Ellis and Eric is, to something that seems to me more universalist than I wish to be. But to their credit, they're working on it. They are also very aware of the need to do some cognitive science work. And are pushing that. And that does indeed please me. But it's just not, it's the one place in all of this that theologically I feel awkward and can't present their case well. Then interior to that is, excuse me, the damnedest thing to have happened in emergence Christianity in a very long time. Never would have dreamed. Even 3 years ago, I would not have dreamed this was going to happen. In my defense, let me say that Ryan Folger and Eddie Gibbs both have said the same thing. They didn't see it coming either, and they're the absolute authorities. Here are the hyphenateds. Good night. I need a caution pin. Well, that's a D. You never know it. S. Anyway, the hyphenateds. These are the folk who fascinate me. These are the folk who are what we were doing this morning. That was an Anglo Merchant service, if ever I saw one. It's exactly what it was. Hyphenated means simply, originally these are the folk who have emergent sensibilities, but who want to stay within the corpus. If you will, they've got emergence DNA, and they want to stay in the corpus of the denomination, to put it that way. They want to change the DNA and keep the body, or they want to keep at least part of it. Ergo, they call to themselves Anglo-Mergents, or Bapto, B-A-P-T-O, Mergents, or Metho-Mer. Now they've been at it long enough, and they just kind of sprang up. I swear, 6 years ago, you didn't hear the word even. It just wasn't there. And it's just sort of gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's now the most active form, probably, of emergence Christianity, is in the hyphenated circle. And they got shrewd enough, so they dropped the hyphen. So now it's Angli, A-N-G-L-I-M-E-R-G-E-N-T-S, all one word, or Babti, or Babto Mergents. I think they kept the O, but no hyphens. It's all one word now. And they are they're full of energy. They're full of sass and vinegar, as my daddy used to say. You can plant one of these. If you want to plant one, you can make one of these happen, or you can encourage one of these to happen. There's a whole spectrum of possibilities in that. But the truth of the thing is that with the hyphenateds, because they're fair, there are several truths. The first truth is that the Presbyterian Church in the USA was the first church to really understand what was happening. And consistently over the last 5 years, it has been the Presbyterian Church that has understood that indeed we have the church in Antioch and the church in Jerusalem. We have the church in Louisville and the church at Starbucks or the nearest pub. But what we have got is a church that's not going to make more Presbyterian churches. A church that's going to serve the kingdom of God. And I meant that at lunch yesterday. That's a really hard thing to do. It's a really hard thing if you're at national headquarters looking at a national budget that is just big enough to go around those who are behaving themselves instead of going out and doing this thing. But for some reason, by the grace of God, the Presbyterian Church saw early what was happening. And they began to put money into it quietly, very quietly. But they put money into it, helping their ordinance, or their ordained clergy, who didn't want to take a traditional pulpit, go forth and begin one of these things. Now, it is interestingly enough, the Episcopal Church is now following suit. So are all the others. For the first time in December, there was a national meeting in Memphis, handily enough, so I got to go with it without any problem. There was a meeting in Memphis, the first real gathering of emergence Christianity at a national level. It met on Friday and Saturday, but on Thursday, which was the thing that excited me, on Thursday, yeah, all of the emergence group, the hyphenateds, were invited to come, and letters went out for the hyphenateds to come and all meet together as hyphenateds, kind of a cohort of hyphenateds, if you will, for common worship on Thursday, and then Thursday, and to discuss the issue of not being fish nor fowl, what it meant to not be on anybody's budget and to not have anything at all except the good Lord in a download, and then after lunch to meet in their separate groups for the first time, and then to come back for closing worship. It was the most exciting thing I have been to in a long time. And when we gathered in that opening session, don't you know, looking right across the circle from me was Bruce Race Childs, who is the moderator of the Presbyterian Church's General Assembly. He's as high as it gets. It's the Pope. And he's sitting there. And I'm saying, and he said to me, "You're the one who ought to know more than any of the rest of us. This matters." You know? About six weeks ago now, the Presbyterian Church picked all of its emergence or presbyemergent leaders that it could identify as being there and invited them to come at church expense into Louisville, into the church headquarters. And they met there and they talked about Antioch and Jerusalem. They talked about what they were doing, what they needed, what their theology was. Did it match with Reformed theology? Where did it need refining? They spent 2 or 3 days together doing that. That's what every one of us ought to be doing. That's what every denomination ought to be doing with its hyphenateds. And they may or they may not. I'm real pleased to say that the Episcopal Church has gotten a case of this and now understands what's going on. And there, while our presiding bishop was not in Memphis, she sent 3 full-time staff members from national headquarters in to meet with the Anglo merchants and to say the same thing. Where does what do you need? What can we give you? How can we help each other? Where is this going to go? What's the theology like? It was absolutely wonderfully exciting. The Southern Baptist, I don't know whether this is fair to tell or not, because about the 3rd or 4th meeting last year that I was at of Merchants Christianity, I kept seeing this same couple, and they were very, man and wife, they were very, very pleasant, and they told me their name once or twice, which will not be mentioned. And then in New Mexico in March, there was a big meeting, a courtesy of the Roman Catholic Church, as a matter of fact. It was the first time that a Roman organization had had a national emergence Christianity meeting. And it was held by Richard Rohr, Father Rohr, in Albuquerque at the Center for Contemplative Action. And I said to Father Rohr, "How is it you can do this?" And he said, "Well, emergence is not even a word that Rome can spell yet, and so we're under the radar, and until they catch us, we're going to continue to work in this country with emergence." I said, "Fair enough, all right, as long as we're under the radar." And the greatest thing about that meeting, while I'm sidetracking, was that there were 1,000 people there, because that was all the space would hold, and the fire department wouldn't let more in. There were people who paid money to be outside the room in order to hear it, and there was also a web audience that had to register for money to hear the meeting. But there was 1,000 bodies in the thing, and there was the final Eucharist was a huge cross like this in this marvelous space, like this, table after table on that, and table like that on others. And of course, it was to be, the celebrant was to be Roman Catholic. The homilist was to be a Lutheran. And the greeter and the one who gathered, the gathering voice, was to be mine. And so I was down here at this part of the cross and getting ready to call the people to worship. And quickly, one of the little Roman acolytes came over and tugged on me and he says, Mystical, Father says, before you gather the people, be sure you say something about this table is for everybody and all are welcomed here, because we have gays in the audience and we can't say it, and we have non-Catholics and we can't say it, but you're an Anglican, you can say anything." I thought, okay, nailed me on that one. And so I did. I said, "All are welcomed here. This is not the church's table. This is Christ's table." And we got along just fine, and nobody claimed Rome or otherwise or any gender. But anyway, at that meeting, this charming couple came up and said, "We've come to tell you goodbye. We've enjoyed being with you," and they named some places we've been together. And I said, "Oh, where are you going?" "We're going abroad." And I said, "Oh, how lovely." And they said, "We're not sure where we're going yet. We haven't got our assignment." And I said, "What?" And they said, "Well, it's going to be Germany or Sweden one. But central office hasn't told us yet." And I said, "What are you telling me?" And he grinned and said, "Don't tell anybody." So of course I'm telling, you know. He said, "Don't spread it around, but the Southern Baptist Convention has been watching emergence for some time now. And there are a number of us who are on staff paid to find out about it and then to find out about it in Europe and see if we can begin to plant Baptist emergence churches, which is entirely possible. But I was so charmed by the fact that, you know, really under the radar, but very deliberate, and it was my first indication that vendor merchants were getting that kind of support. And good for them. The Anglo merchants, when I say that we are now getting huge support from 815 from our church headquarters, I also said yesterday that the first, frankly, Anglo merchant church in this country was St. Gregory of Nyssa, founded in 1970. And if you have time, you might want to Google that and actually see, because a picture is worth a thousand words. But an Anglo merchant church like St. Gregory, because it's the one I'm most familiar with, it's the one I can best describe in terms of what a hyphenated is, it was built, and emergence Christians are deathly afraid of real estate. One of the things they don't want is to own property. And the reason is very clear. They will say to you, looks like to me about $6 million to put this place together. Looks like to me about $250,000 to keep it up in a year, or something about like that. And there's millions of kids starving to death. What are you thinking about? You know? And you think, ugh, they're right. Until they say, but we need a place to meet Tuesday night. Can we borrow your basement? You know? Yeah. And they're, exactly. I mean, and it's such a contradiction. And they don't see it, and it drives me insane that they don't see it. At least when they say it to a Seventh-day Adventist, it makes a certain amount of sense, because, you know, they're clearly not going to use theirs on Sunday, and so you can. But they're deathly allergic to owning the real estate kind of thing. Anyway, St. Gregory of Nyssa was built as an Anglo merchant, and that's fairly rare. Your hyphenateds are more willing to deal with real estate. One of the, because the Episcopal Church is the one that's suffering the greatest splintering right now, and I'm going to quit a minute and let you have a break. I've just realized that I'm babbling on. The Episcopal Church is the one that's suffering right now from the greatest number of splits, like what happened at Grace and New Grace here, leaving buildings sometimes with indeed 24, 25 still surviving parishioners and a whole lot of property that they can't do anything with. One of the reasons that our national headquarters is interested in the Anglo merchants right now is that those places do become available for planting hyphenated churches. It's a wonderful use for those spaces, and it's being very productive. And I'm pretty sure that that's what happened here at Grace. I don't know how much diocesan help they got, but I'm pretty sure that's what happened. But St. Gregory's of Nyssa really was built as a hyphenated church before we had that word. It was built as an attempt to, and it's in California, where we all know funny things happen, right? You know, California's always out there, and when it doesn't work, they hide it in an earthquake, and when it does, they claim it. But anyway, they're very farsighted. Yeah, very farsighted. Huge center doors that are never closed, except when it's raining or the air conditioning requires something, which doesn't happen all that often in San Francisco, but that are never locked, certainly. And you go immediately into a huge space that just has an altar, a massive altar on it, and there's an adjacent room, which is obviously where the service itself happens. That altar is used all week long for various and sundry things, but specifically on Friday. Every Friday, 9,000 pounds of food are given out to the homeless, or to those who wish to come and claim food. I don't know what 9,000 pounds of food looks like, but every Friday, and it is served on that altar with the deliberate intention of expressing the fact that we are feeding you on Christ's altar. When you go into the adjacent room, it's all chairs, no pews, it's all chairs, and they are facing each other in choir like this, and there is a chair up there, and you homilize or you preach, whoever's doing it, and let me tell you, the hot seat takes on new definition when you're sitting in it. I put my little self down in it and thought, dear Lord, why am I here? You sit there and you deliver the homily sitting down, and then you're invited to shut up. After you're done, and please don't go more than 20 minutes, 15 is enough. And then the people began to tell you what they did and didn't agree with, and to ask you to prove your point, and to see where it's applicable, and, you know, it's the people doing the Word of God. All you're doing is starting it. You're just starting the conversation and telling the subject matter it's going to be dealing with, and then the people do it. And then when that part is over, we say the confession and we go out to the front room and we gather around the altar dancing, dancing and music. Then the Eucharist is offered each to the other. And I take a piece of bread from a neighbor and I consume it, and then I turn to you and say, the body of Christ broken for us, it is the bread of salvation. And you turn to him and you turn to her, and so it goes. In that room, there is a rotunda of the saints of God, and Mahatma Gandhi is there, and all kinds of people. Mother Jones is up there. That's what an Anglo-Emergence looks like. It is absolutely so traditional, you would know you were in an Episcopal church or an Orthodox church. You couldn't miss it. It overwhelms you, but it doesn't play by the rules. It plays by some kind of, I'd say, orthonomy. The music sings. There's a book on your bibliography, Eat This Bread, by Sarah Miles, who is not ordained, is Jewish actually, is not ordained, but is their associate rector, or associate leader, talking about her conversion some years ago at St. Gregory, having wandered in an atheist going, not even knowing why, just thought the building was interesting, and she passed it every day, and so she just stopped and went in, and was just fine until the neighbor next to her put the bread in her mouth. And it's a very moving story she tells. And she said, suddenly, God and I knew the truth. And was converted right there on the spot with the bread still in her mouth. So that's the kind of St. Gregory thing. Now, I have kept you way over break, and so let's take 15 minutes. I want to ask you, please, to do something on that break. See what the right hand giveth, the left hand taketh away. I want you to do, assume that you are British citizens. And that Elizabeth, by the grace of God, will most surely die sometime soon. She can't live forever, though she's well on her way to proving it. And that Philip will go with her. And we all have a problem with that stunning crown prince who shows so much aptitude for ineptitude. But and so you're British. And suddenly it's up to you and to your fellow citizens to decide whether the monarchy should go on or not, should be continued. And if so, on what terms? The question is, how would you vote? To keep it or to stash it? And if to stash it, why? And if to keep it, why? I heard you, Bill. Well, sounds like an Anglican. He said, okay, so I don't know who's the head of China that could be.
The whole point of a monarchy is you don't get to vote. I'm Canadian. That's my queen you're talking
about. Okay. Then you know that's your queen. I'm sorry. But she is immortal. You got to admit.
But her mother lived in Jordan.
I know she did. I know it. Along with some other interesting things in that DNA. What a bloodline.
It's always been that way.
Think about it. Seriously. Because what I'm trying to do is distance the question from us by taking it into a different... Yeah.